Following the advice of Deep Throat, the giants of industrial agriculture have followed the money into organic farming. To determine how organic these industrials have become, the federal government has just completed an audit of its national organic program. This government look into a government program leads us to ask, how organic is organic?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 677th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Frankfurt who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford is off today, but we have producer Kelsey Olson on the phones.
Hello.
Kelsey. Folks, the giants of the industrial food chain have become organic. Yes, we're talking Coca-Cola, Nestle's, General Mills, Kraft, Kellogg's. You know, the big get big by being smart. And so when the federal government threw open the gates to the fresh green pastures of organic agriculture, the smart stampeded through. As a consequence, the business of organic agriculture has blossomed. In 2001, organic foods rang up a cool $20 billion. But by 2007, the cash register totaled well over $47 billion. Today, organic agriculture is yum. But wait, how did those industrial giants produce so much organic foods with technologies that were not supposed to be so, well, industrial? To get a sense of what is going on out there in those green pastures, the federal government audited its own national organic program. This program provides us with a perfect opportunity to ask, how organic is organic? And who better to ask than one of the intellectual godparents of organic agriculture, and we're talking, of course, about Fred Kirschenman. Fred, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
So is that a fair thing to call you an intellectual godparent of the organic agriculture?
I don't know. I've been called worse. So.
You've been called worse, and you certainly were, because you were there at the beginning and encouraging, and at the beginning of most profound movements, there is some kind of intellectual stimulus, and I guess that's what you were. You were one of the people who were providing the intellectual impetus for this organic movement. And I guess a little bit about your background would help people understand why you were capable of doing that. One, of course, is that you're from a farm family, and you are a farmer, right?
That's correct.
You got, what, 3,500 acres up there in North Dakota?
That's correct, yeah.
Something like that. And what do you grow?
Well, if you're organic, you have to be pretty diversified, because you have to have, you know, crop rotations, et cetera, and so it's the only way it works. So our operation in the first place is primarily a small grain and livestock operation, mm-hmm. and 1,000 acres of our farm is still a native prairie, which we use for grazing our beef animals. And then in the crop part of it...
That certainly doesn't sound industrial, to have 1,000 acres of native prairie.
Yeah, well, it's not industrial. You know, we found out a long time ago that industrial is increasingly not working and will not work even more so as energy costs go up. So we're right in the process still of trying to transition to, a future that's going to make the farm sustainable under the new circumstances. And we can probably talk about that later if you want.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the crop part of it, we basically have three different crop rotations in our pattern that we use. And so overall, we have about seven or eight different crops in each growing season.
Fair enough. But as a young man, you left the farm, did you not? You went away to school. And I mention this, Fred, because so many of us did.
Yeah, you know, the initial influence in my life was my father, and my father and mother started farming on our farm in North Dakota in 1930 when they got married. And so their first years on the farm were in the midst of the Dust Bowl,
wow,
which was you know, very sobering lesson from my father. And he somehow understood intuitively that the Dust Bowl wasn't just about the weather. It was also about the way they farmed. Mm-hmm. And he saw the damage which that kind of weather pattern could do to his land. And so he determined that that would never, ever happen to his land again. And so consequently, he became, and I have to make this very clear, in his own terms, a radical conservationist, which right. means he wasn't always on the same side of the issues as the Soil Conservation Service. But taking care of the land was extremely important. And I can still remember from the time I was probably 5 years old, he would lecture me. With his finger pointed at me, telling me that taking care of the land was the most important thing that every farmer needs to do. And so I kind of grew up with that ethical mandate. It was just as important as helping your neighbor or any other kind of, you know, moral obligation was to take care of the land. So that was really that seed that was planted in me, and it just became a part of the way I thought. My father also was insistent that I get as much education as I could because he was denied that. And so there was never a question that I was going to go to college. It was simply understood I would need to go to college. So I went off to college and then graduate school and then ended up in a career in higher education.
Well, wait a minute. Did you have a degree in a doctorate's degree in philosophy?
That's correct. So right, yeah.
What did your father think about that when you
well he was you know he I think he never anticipated that I would go that far,
but
he was very pleased about it, you know, because this was sort of a confirmation of his belief that you know, that if people have an opportunity to get an adequate education, then there are and they have a determination, there are really no limits to what they can accomplish. He believed that very much, and so I was, for him, kind of a confirmation of that, yeah.
So I have to ask, what impact did your being raised on a farm have to do with your studies in philosophy?
If you grow up on a farm, and especially if you're a farmer, you have to be a pragmatist, because
that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. You have to have results from what you do. Otherwise, you're just not going to be in business very long. And so it tended to lead me toward, pragmatic kinds of considerations. But also with having this sense of values instilled in me, meant that that was also a driving force for me. So my education I sort of drifted in the direction of how do you apply practical considerations to values issues. So I was concerned throughout my college education and my graduate school, I was concerned with issues of how do you determine the right values that will really have a practical application, you know, in ordinary life. That was sort of what drove me. So that's the direction that I went in.
Let me pitch this to you. I just had a couple of days ago. I had lunch with a bank president here in the community, and she talked about watching the Food Channel with her children and seeing and pointing out vegetables, raw vegetables, and on television, and asking her children what they were.
Yeah.
And her children looked at a potato and didn't know what a potato was because, they've never seen a potato before, a whole potato.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for those of us who have not seen any whole ethics before, what do you mean by ethics?
Well, it's, part of the industrialization issue that you talked about earlier not only affected our food and agriculture system, but affected our whole culture. And it's from the beginning of the industrialization, which, you know, I would at least argue goes back at least to Bacon and Descartes. And both of them were kind of sort of set the stage for the scientific revolution in which you had to separate your facts and values, because facts were based on what you could observe, what you could, you know, put into a test tube, what you could experiment with. Values were sort of opinions. They were subjective things. And so he wanted to keep those separate. And so it's no surprise to me that we live in a culture today in which, people aren't very well informed around what ethics and values are. But they're basically, you know, all of us, if you think about it, all of us, even scientists who decide to do these reductionistic kinds of experiments. They decide what's important to do research on. That's a values judgment. And it's based on what you sense, you know, through your experience, through, you know, your whole background, what's really most important. And that's what you're going to, you know, put time into.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, what's most important, at least for something that we share, of course, is what we eat. And that's what we're talking about today is
right.
the what we eat and the organic food that we eat and just how organic yeah. is organic. And we are a person who truly is one of the intellectual godparents of organic agriculture, Fred Kirschemann. Kirschemann Family Farms up there in North Dakota, also a distinguished fellow with the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, Iowa State University. And, of course, we have you, too. Are you getting your money's worth from organic food? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Fred Kirschemann, Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. We will be right back, so do not go away.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, we spend a lot of money on organic food, over probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 billion a year. Man, that's a big bucks. So, are we getting our money's worth? How organic is organic? The federal government just looked into the national, its own national organic program and did an audit. And what that audit found is the subject of this show, The Food Chain, with Michael Olson. Fred Kirschemann is our guest. He is an intellectual godparent of the organic agriculture, president of Kirschemann Family Farms up there in North Dakota, distinguished fellow, Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, Iowa State University. Fred, you know, it's been said that we have the most productive agriculture in the world. We have cheap food, et cetera, et cetera. But something must have been missing for us to want to go in this direction of our organic agriculture. What was missing?
Well, I think there were and still are a number of things missing. You know, the industrial foods, and I don't use industrial incidentally as a pejorative term. It's a descriptive term.
Yeah, that's what I think. It's a different kind of technology.
Yeah, right, yeah. It's basically like any other industrial economy. The basic goal of industrial agriculture is maximum efficient production and short-term economic return.
Right.
And to accomplish that, you need to specialize, you need to simplify your management, and you need to go for economies of scale. And that's exactly what's happened to agriculture. And that provides you with certain results and certain benefits. It provides you with a lot of stuff that you can sell at a relatively cheap price. And it does give short-term economic return to certain players in the system. What's missing in the equation is that there was little attention to quality, there was little attention to health, there was little attention to ecological resilience or ecological restoration. What I mean by that is what's happening to the resources of agriculture, like the quality of the soil, biodiversity. Those are all critical elements in terms of long-term sustainability in agriculture.
All of those things that your father sensed blowing away.
That's right,
in the wind.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And there are certain things that begin to turn up in the food system. You know, obesity and diabetes now is one of the most critical healthcare problems that we have that are emerging as enormous costs to us and costs to the public. Mm-hmm. Now, a diet isn't the only source of obesity and diabetes, but it is absolutely clear that it is a major factor.
89.95%.
That's right, yeah.
Something
and
like
so,
that.
So, and then you have now, you know, other issues that we have to deal with. And I don't know how much you want to get into this, but, you know, when you have a front page story in the New York Times about a young woman who is paralyzed for life because she ate a hamburger, you know, it's going to cause people to start asking questions mm-hmm. about their food. And so they're wanting to not have those negative consequences, and so that I think is more than anything else that has led people to begin to investigate what else is out there, what else could I eat that is provides more of what I want in terms of good taste, in terms of health, in terms of, you know, satisfying my family. And that probably more than anything else, I think, has driven this increase in interest in organic food.
Well, Fred, as you started nudging the world into toward a different direction back when, you picked up the word organic and used the word organic. Why did you use the word organic to describe this kind of agriculture?
Yeah, well, that's, of course, the heart of what you want to talk about today, and I do too. You know, I served on the National Organic Standards Board for 5 years, just at the time that the regulations were being written to implement the law. And, you know, we were engaged in a lot of discussion and controversies, you can well imagine. And there were a number of us on the National Organic Standards Board that wanted to make sure that the regulations that we came up with would install some of the core principles of organic agriculture that we believed in and that we were, that informed us by some of the, you know, original thinkers in organic agriculture, like C.S. Howard, like Sir Albert Howard, and you know, there are a number of people back then in the early and mid 1900s that really created the concept of organic, and at the very core of that, for Sir Albert Howard, for example, was that you had to maintain the quality of the soil, and the best way to do that was to enrich the humus in the soil, because that was the food source for the incredible life in the soil, and that in turn is what would give you healthy plants and healthy animals, and therefore healthy foods for humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to instill some of this ecological concept into the law. And there were actually people in the National Organic Program that were open to that and wanted to do that. But what we discovered when they read these kinds of, as you can tell even from my conversation here, complex issues, trying to insert those complex issues into a legal system, and the lawyers at USDA said, can't do that, you know, in a regulatory system.
I can hear them now.
In a regulatory system, they said, you have to be able to answer with a yes or a no.
Uh-huh.
You can't put something in that's, you know, this complex kind of stuff.
Does this take us back to the facts versus values?
Yeah, right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Because then what we had to come down to is what can you use and not use in an organic system. And that's why what we have now in the law is you cannot use synthetic inputs except those that are put on the allowable synthetic list. And you can use natural inputs except those that are on the unallowed list. There are some things in,
like raw manure.
Well, you can use raw manure under certain circumstances, but things like arsenic, for example. Arsenic is a natural material, but it's not allowed. It's on the non-allowed list in organic.
Okay.
So we ended up with this, you know, this sort of mathematical approach to instilling organic. So, you know, it's possible for somebody to be a certified organic farmer that doesn't really pay attention to the biological health of his or her soil. And, you know, to me, that's what's not organic about organic in our current system.
Let me backtrack just a little bit. And because before organic became an official government property, it was widely used in a million different ways by a million different farmers.
Yeah.
Everybody had their own definition of it.
That's right, yeah.
Why was the name given to the government?
Well, you know, as you can well imagine, back then in the, you know, late 1980s, when we were wrestling with all of this, there were a number of us, including myself, that really agonized over this. You know, do we really want to involve the government in something that's a very passionate, private, you know, kind of interest that we all had? But we, at that time, were very clear about what happened to the natural label. You know, and, you know, all at once, when natural became popular, everybody was using it. There was no, you could not. You had no way of knowing when you went into a store and bought something with a natural label what that really meant.
It didn't really mean anything. Yeah, right.
Yeah, we didn't want that to happen to organic, and that's why we decided that we needed to have some kind of uniform definition of what organic was, and the only thing we could figure out that could do that was to, you know, support the effort at that time that was going on within USDA to move, you know, to have an organic standard.
Did the small farmers feel the least bit nervous about handing their property to the government?
I'm sorry, were they nervous?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because,
you know,
because
we had long conversations about that.
Yeah, it was the one thing that they had that industrial agriculture really didn't have, because, you know, since it had no definition, it was really hard for, you know, industrial scaled producers to call themselves organic, because it never really knew what the heck it meant.
Well, actually, our concern was the opposite, and that was that if you didn't have a strict standard, you know, everybody would start
everybody
to use the term organic
it.
Just like they use the term natural, and then it would lose all its meaning.
Okay, fair enough. Folks, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. When we come back, we're going to ask Fred Kirschemann what happened to organic when the federal government took over the ownership. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080 at phone numbers today. Question we have for you out there, do you get your money's worth when you buy organic foods? What do you think? We'd love to hear what you have to say. And we'd love to hear what questions you might have for Fred. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, with Fred Kirschemann, right back. Well, it's huge business these days, this organic agriculture. Head down to the store and our supermarket shelves are lined with organic foods, bringing in somewhere north of $50 billion. Who knows? That's a lot of money. And some very big players are involved in that industry. Gosh, we're talking Coca-Cola, Kraft Foods, Hunt Wesson, you name it. They're all there because that's what we want. We want good food. And we look to that organic label as a certification that the food, in fact, is good. Today we're talking about what's really in that food, how organic is organic food, and are we getting our money's worth? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1980. We have Fred Kirschemann with us today. Fred is one of the intellectual godparents of the organic food movement, a PhD in philosophy, and a farmer. And you put those two together, and you get some great thoughts about where we should be heading with our agriculture. So, Fred, I guess my next question is, when the government took over organic farming, what happened to the industry? It exploded, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's probably not so much that the government took it over that caused the explosion. As I said earlier, what caused the explosion was the interest on the part of a growing number of people in the food consumer world that were looking for alternatives, and the fact that it was. I think most people who, and I don't know of any real scientific survey about this, but. You know, people that I talk to and friends of mine who are involved in the food industry, they tell me that, you know, if you ask an ordinary customer whether or not they're happy with the certification, you know, of the organic food, they don't really know what you're talking about.
That's right.
So they're not interested in those details. What they're interested in is having confidence, having a trusting relationship.
That's
increasingly
right.
Is important. Mm-hmm. And I think that... That, to me, is part of the good news, because it means that simply having a label is increasingly, as we move into our new future, not going to be adequate. People want to have information that actually enables them to enter into a relationship, preferably back to the farmer that produces the food.
Food with its farmer's face on it.
That's right. That's right. And this is where I think that the current administration is working very hard to revolutionize not just organic but our entire food system. Kathleen Merrigan, who actually served with us on the National Organic Standards Board back, you know, in the early days, is very convenient. She has now created this program, Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food, which is not just about organic. It's about creating these relationships. Organic has to participate in that if it's going to be successful in this new future.
Let me backtrack quickly before we get into the actual audit and whatnot and the new programs being developed.
Yeah.
But when the government, you know, assumed a sponsorship of organic agriculture, I don't know how you said it, when it took organic into the National Organic Program, didn't that provide kind of a legalistic framework so
sure.
that everybody could say, okay, this is what organic is, and this is where we need to go, this is what we can do, and away. Didn't that provide a tremendous impetus for the industry as well?
Well, sure. I think it probably did, because, again, if you remember, I said to you, industrialization is about specialization,
mm-hmm.
simplifying the management, economies of scale. And so when you reduce organic to a yes and no kind of framework, then it lends itself to that. And, the larger industry players, and again, this is not to castigate them, but to recognize that's how business is done in that world.
Mm-hmm.
Organic's a nice fit for that, because they don't have to worry about all the complexity that, you know, an organic farmer who really wants to use organic principles has to deal with. All they have to worry about is, does it meet the standard? Does it meet the requirement? Has it been certified? Where's the seal? Where's the document? And then they can market it, so it simplifies it.
Now, with respect to that simplification, didn't that provide a tremendous boost to the industry as well as the demand?
I mean, oh, sure.
It's clear that there are buyers there, but there. How on earth did they manage to produce so much food to supply that demand?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and as a farmer, right now the demand is down. And I think, you know, there are a number of reasons which, you know, go back to 2007 and the food crisis and all of that and what happened after that. But the growth of organic sales has gone down some in 2009. It appears to be starting to go up again now. And I think the short answer to your question is that increasingly, the organic, foods and raw materials for organic processing are being imported.
Ah, okay. We're getting our food from organic food from China, aren't we?
That's right. Uh-huh. That's right. Yeah.
And I saw somewhere that of the nations producing organic foods in the world, that Australia was number one in acreage, overall acreage, and China was number two.
Yeah, I haven't really looked at those. They change, you know, from year to year.
Year to
I haven't
year,
looked
yeah.
at them recently, but I know they've increased, yeah.
Okay. So how on earth are we keeping track of what's going on in all of this world?
Well, that's a really important question, and I know that the National Organic Program has been overwhelmed with that, technically.
Typically, what happens with government is that you establish a policy, and then all kinds of people who have financial stakes in the industry start lobbying you to do this and to that to make it possible for them to participate. Is that what did that happen with organic agriculture?
Well, yeah. I mean, there were, and this doesn't even have anything to do with imported food. It had to do even with companies in the United States who wanted to simplify things a little bit more, or make it. It was an effort at one point to not require all of the feed fed to organic poultry to be organic, to have a lower percentage of that. So there have been those efforts. Fortunately, have not been successful. But you're right, there is that pressure there, obviously, and so we have to constantly pay attention to it.
Yeah, and I think one of the best examples of that was Horizon Dairy's giant feedlot dairy operations.
Yeah.
In organic agriculture, the spirit of organic agriculture was that, these dairy cows would be eating grass or something. And then all of a sudden they're confined in little pens, just like industrial agriculture.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a very interesting story behind that, because I was the chair of the Livestock Committee at the National Organic Standards Board at the time we were writing the regulations for that. And everybody on the Livestock Committee was in agreement that ruminant animals should be essentially, out on pasture.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
You mean ruminant animals should be eating grass.
Ruminant animals are, cows,
right.
Sheep, et cetera. And so we... we crafted this language in which we said that ruminant animals have to have access to pasture, which we thought was pretty clear. Well, we weren't quite sophisticated enough to recognize how people would use language, and we started to get feedback that some of these larger operations were saying, well, this is not a problem, so we'll have 10 acres and leave the gate open and they'll have access to pasture. We said, wait a minute, that's not what we had in mind. So we then proposed a change in the language to change it from access to pasture to it has to be pasture-based, so that it has to be a pasture system.
Can you hold the rest of this? We have to take a quick break.
Okay,
folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Fred Kirschman and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. And so the organic milk that we pay the extra bucks for on the shelves of our supermarkets, how organic is that organic milk? Well, there was a significant amount of conflict over just how organic that was. And when people actually looked at the giant organic dairies that were producing that organic milk, they scratched their heads and said, well, hey, wait a minute. Fred Kirschman, you were there at the time. Was that a, hey, wait a minute moment for organic agriculture?
Yeah, it certainly was. And, everything goes through this kind of, evolutionary process. And the same thing's been true with this. And eventually, if you have sufficient information, if the
right.
consumer public gets enough information, eventually they know they're not getting what they thought they were getting, and then you start to have to deal with that. And in this case, fortunately, and again, I think it's a testimony to Kathleen Merrigan's leadership, mm-hmm. to Miles McAvoy's leadership. In just the first year of this administration, they were actually able now to change the rule and the requirements for pasture. That is, and I haven't read its actual text, but from everything that I've read and heard, is exactly what the Livestock Committee back in the early 1990s was proposing. So we've finally gotten there now.
Right.
And
do you think that it will always be a game of catch me if you can kind
of? Well, I don't think so, because here's the really good news from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
As I said earlier, one of the things that the consuming public wants now is a trusting relationship. Well, now we may move toward more localized food systems as we move into the future, particularly as energy costs go up. That could very likely happen. But even before that happens, one of the things that has developed in our world now is electronic relationships. So we now have the technology that enables a consumer to go into a store, pick up a product, and scan it across the computer scanner, and the barcode will tell them exactly where the ingredients for that food came from and who the farmers were that produced it.
Wow.
Already now you can go on the websites of many farmers, and more importantly, in some ways, these aggregations of farmers who have developed their marketing networks with their own brand, like an Organic Valley. And so you can go on their website, and there are YouTube clips which actually show you what's going on the farm of these farmers who are a part of that network. And that makes it much more difficult to do any kind of false advertising. I mean, you could probably still get away with some of it.
Do you think we'll ever be able to get the organic melamine out of the food chain from China?
Well, I mean, this is the other thing. It's is the more that happens, the more people are going to say, I don't want to buy anything from China. I want to be able to scan this food and know that it comes from a farmer that I can trust.
So there you are. I talked with a fellow yesterday who's having a new BMW convertible built in Germany. And he's looking at the job order, and it said the interior had white walnut or light walnut and dark walnut. And he got freaked out, so he looked up the website of the manufacturing plant, and he emailed the plant manager and asked her to look into it. And she walked out onto the assembly line floor and looked into the car and looked at the computer order and fixed everything and emailed them back and said, "You get your dark walnut and your car is beautiful." And that's what you're talking about, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
So, you don't think that you will be able to take we consumers will be able to take that ersatz organic, that industrial scale stuff that's coming from giant factories, who knows where?
I think, and here again is where I think, we need to kind of anticipate a little bit the kind of changes that are going to come at us that none of us are going to have any control of. We know that our energy costs are going to go up.
Right.
We know that we're very likely in most places going to have more unstable climates. We know that on a global basis, we can't continue to use as much fresh water in our food and agriculture system we have because we're draining down our fresh water resources. These are all going to have impacts. And I think one of the impacts that it will have is that and we're starting to see this already in the literature, is going to make the concept of the food shed. A food shed is a metaphor which is borrowed from a watershed. Watersheds are not all the same size. They're not uniform.
Mm-hmm.
They're adapted to their place, but they're appropriate to their place. And that metaphor is now being borrowed increasingly in terms of our food system. And increasingly, consumers are saying, I don't want to just be a consumer. I don't want to just, my friend Bill Heffernan once said that if the industrial food system were to choose an appropriate logo for itself, it would be just eat it. Don't ask where it came from. Don't ask how it was made.
Just eat it and shut up.
Yeah. Well, increasingly, consumers are saying, I don't want to just be a passive consumer anymore. I want to have some involvement, some engagement. And so what we're starting to see, and I'm also involved now with the Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture just out of New York City, and so I'm getting an opportunity now to have some in-depth conversations with people in an urban center like New York City around food issues. And increasingly what they're saying is that we want to be food citizens. We want to be engaged with farmers. We want to be engaged with other people in the food system. And so that we determine from the bottom up what kind of food that's going to be available to us in our community, not from the top down, that's determined by some, big corporation.
Sounds like Jefferson or something like that. Folks, this is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. When we get back, we're going to ask Fred Kirschman the big question, which is, how organic is organic? We will be right back. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Fred Kirschman. Well, we're down to a few minutes, and we have the big question, which is exactly how organic is organic, Fred Kirschman?
Well, it's not as organic overall as I would like to see it, because I think some of these core principles, which are exactly what we need to implement as we face these challenges in the future that I was talking about.
We're talking about the principles we need to protect our environment and our food, right?
So it's two main things are restoring the biological health of our soil so that the soil is has self-renewing capacity in it. I mean, that's going to be increasingly important as our energy costs go up. And that restores the biodiversity of the planet, because it's the biodiversity that provides the resilience we're going to need under the new challenges.
And both of these are diametrically opposed to industrial.
They are. They absolutely are. And that's the key. That's the key problem with our industrial food system. And it gives the comparative advantage as we move into our future to well-managed organic systems. And I think we'll start to see that happen. When crude oil went to $147 a barrel, and hydrous ammonia, which is the key source of nitrogen for farmers in Iowa, went from $200 a ton to over $1,000 a ton, a lot of farmers started to ask the question about whether or not they should consider going organic under those circumstances. So I think we're going to see that happen. Now, in the meantime, I still think personally that buying organic food is a good deal, because even if you don't pay the kind of attention to the biological health of your soil that I would like to see, you generally are managing your soil in ways that are going to provide some of that benefit, and in turn, you're going to see, and most of the research has verified this, you're going to see increased nutrient value in your food. And we should stop asking the question about the cost of my food based on how much I pay per ounce or per calorie, and start asking how much am I paying for my food based on its nutrient value, because that's what gives you the real benefit.
Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. And I guess that's kind of where you're going with that. If we buy cheap food, it's really expensive food, isn't it?
Yeah.
So can we have industrial organic?
Well, no, you can't. If what you mean by industrial is what we've been talking about,
yeah, exactly.
Then you can't, because they're different. They're entirely different methods of production.
And so how are we to know other than? So we have to find out for ourselves, don't we? We really can't trust anyone.
Well, and this is why these relationships and these electronic transparency mm-hmm. systems become so important. And I think one of the things that every customer, when they go into a store, can do is to ask the manager of the produce section, for example, you know, where exactly did this food come from? Yes. And if they can't answer that question, you might ask them, why can't you answer that question? You know, is that not important? Is that not an important part of your sales system? And if it isn't, maybe I want to go to a different store for whom that is an important part of the sale.
So what we consumers can do is really buy food with its farmer's face on it and take upon ourselves responsibility
right.
of learning where that food comes from.
And the other thing for food customers to recognize is they have enormous power. Because
yes.
people who are in the food business can't replace a lost customer by getting their current customer to eat more, because all of us can only eat so much. So they are very concerned about keeping their current customers.
Fred Kirschman, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain. Folks, stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio on The Food Chain. Thank you, Fred.
My pleasure to be with you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.